you can airdrop me into almost anywhere, right, I'm going to find a great time. And I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to immerse myself in the culture. And isn't that what travel's supposed to be?
Welcome back to Success Unscripted, the podcast where we peel back the curtain on real stories of success in the business world. I'm your host, Jonathan Israel, a financial advisor with Affinity Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services. To make my compliance officers happy, I'll mention that UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC. My office is located in Los Angeles, California, and I can be reached at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Today, I'm speaking with multiple Emmy-winning investigative reporter and producer Peter Greenberg. Peter is America's most recognized frontline travel news journalist. Known in the industry as the Travel Detective, he is the travel editor for CBS News and the host of the Eye on Travel podcast. His website, petergreenberg.com, is a leading travel news resource for consumers and industry insiders alike. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
And happy to be with you.
That intro, by the way, was the short version. You have quite the resume. I do want to ask you about travel, maybe get a few tips for our listeners. But first, I want to know how this all came to be. When did you first become interested in travel?
Well, I've been traveling, believe it or not, since I was 6 months old. I don't remember that particular flight, but that's where it started with my parents. I do remember one thing is it was given to me later that when we landed in Los Angeles, the flight attendants, in those days called stewardesses, and the pilot all signed a certificate and gave it to me. I still have it. It's hanging on my wall, making me the first member of the American Airlines Sky Cradle Club.
No. That's amazing.
And I'm still waiting for my benefits. But forgetting that,
right.
I really started traveling professionally when I was about 17. I was a student at the University of Wisconsin at a time, which of course will date me, during all the anti-war protests with Vietnam. The campuses were blowing up. Wisconsin, the most active and violent campus in America, more than Columbia and Berkeley and Kent State combined. I was working for the student newspaper, but we were the focal point for the mainstream media. And before I knew it, I was hired as a correspondent by Newsweek. And I followed the quote from Mark Twain that I would never let school interfere with my education. And I ended up traveling all over the United States, covering those stories for Newsweek at a very young age. And so I literally have been traveling almost nonstop since I was 17.
Did you grow up in Wisconsin?
No, I grew up in Manhattan. I'm a New York City boy. I was able to go to Wisconsin, to which I credit my entire career, and I'm thankful for them forever for allowing me to be there and then have this wonderful opportunity.
That's amazing. So you really started traveling with your parents. So this was something that was ingrained. This is just something you guys did as far back as you can remember.
Oh, yeah. My grandfather, by the way, was basically the number one assistant to Donald Douglas, Douglas Aviation out in California. So I grew up with every model airplane you can imagine. I was an aviation geek from a very young age.
So you started your career in journalism as a West Coast correspondent for Newsweek.
Yes, I did.
And what kind of stories were you working on?
Well, it was a lot more than just travel. Imagine every major cover story from Watergate to Patty Hearst to Gary Gilmore, Howard Hughes, of course, Vietnam. And then we covered the major cultural stories on the West Coast, cover stories on the Rolling Stones and Bette Midler and Sinatra and the Beatles. And so that involved travel as well, because I was on tour with some of these guys.
Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting. I know you also played a role in the development of the show MacGyver. So walk me through the history here, because you started as a journalist, but it seems to be you always had some kind of travel piece to it. But then you had this entertainment
side. Well, travel was incidental because I was always the guy with a suitcase in the trunk of my car traveling to the scene of something to cover it. And it dawned on me at a very early part of my career, and this goes back to Newsweek, that nobody was covering travel and transportation as front page news. And so I said, you know what? In order to do that, I have to understand it. And so what I did using my access as a journalist was thoroughly immerse myself in the process of travel. So I got thoroughly trained in the cockpit, in the cabins. I got thoroughly trained on the bridges of cruise ships. I still carry cockpit and jump seat authority from the FAA. I couldn't get it today, but it was grandfathered in. I had it way before 9/11. And I still train in the simulators about 5 or 6 times a year, not because I'm a licensed pilot, because I am not a licensed pilot, but I want to understand the process so I can explain it to my audience. And I did that starting back in 1973. And that's what got me to do all the travel stories. What got me to Paramount was something else. Because when I was at Newsweek, I covered a number of stories that everybody wanted to do as movies. And it turned out the only person that they trusted in terms of the sources to do the movie rights was me. What were my credentials as a producer? Nothing. But one of the stories, one of my very first stories that I did was the long investigative piece, and this is also going to date me, on what really happened when the comedian who was the hottest show on television at the time, Freddie Prinze, not Freddie Prinze Jr., but his father, Freddie Prinze, put a gun to his head and killed himself. And that was my story that really broke the ice on what really happened. And we ended up doing that with me as a producer for CBS as a 2-hour movie. And then I did another movie for CBS based on a story I did for Newsweek about war games in the desert played by the Air Force that are so realistic that pilots are actually killing each other. That's a true story. Those games are still going on, by the way. It's called Red Flag out of Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. And so we did that as a movie, and I'm proud to say my chief pilot in that movie was someone some of your audience might remember, Chuck Yeager. And that was a thrill for me. And then was a movie that we did was probably one of the most controversial movies ever made for television. In fact, it only aired once, but I'm glad it did. We broke the ice on that one by doing a dramatic movie, but really an expose on the ethics of television evangelists, television ministers. It's called Pray TV. It starred John Ritter. May he
P-R-E-Y?
No, well, it could be, but it wasn't.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Pray TV, P-R-A-Y.
Oh, okay.
It starred John Ritter and Ned Beatty and Richard Colley. A tremendous cast.
Wow.
And then what happened after that, which is now a long way to go to answer your question, is that Paramount wanted to develop a series about me. And so I went and had a meeting with them. And at the end of the meeting, things turned around. They said, you know what? We'd rather have you come over here and run television, dramatic television. And so I did. And the very first thing we put together, which became one of the biggest hits they ever had, and in fact, at that point, it was the biggest hit they ever had in the one-hour format, was MacGyver. So we did MacGyver there, and then later on, I moved over to MGM Television, where I developed a show that you, of course, may remember called 30-something. And then, of course, I never gave up my journalism, and I never gave up writing about travel. But remember, most people who think they write about travel, I don't hold this against anybody, but they're writing about lovely destinations and happy Hong Kong and beautiful Bermuda. That's not me. I'm an investigative reporter. So what I write about is which cruise ship is a floating fire trap, which cruise ship isn't, which hotel has a terrible security system, which hotel doesn't, which airline, you know, has a problem with their maintenance, which airline lies to you about their frequent flyer program. The answer for that one is everybody. But in any case, those are the stories that I did then, and those are the stories that I continue to do now. And those are the stories that I'm now producing for my own shows on PBS, Amazon, and Apple.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think about someone like you who's traveling a lot, there's a lot of what to do, where to go, and what to see, and all of that stuff. And I'm a fan of your podcast, and I love that, you know, you do a lot of really relevant news, a lot of safety information. You know, you cover some of the stuff that's been going on with Boeing extensively, and just safety and airplane safety and traveling in general, which I think is fantastic.
Well, that's my background going back to Newsweek. There hasn't been, I'm not boasting about this because you never want to have to cover it, but there has not been a significant airline disaster since 1979 that I haven't covered in terms of the investigation and the actual probable cause and what was done after that. And so the Boeing story was right up my alley from day one, and we're still covering it. It's a story that's not going to go away anytime soon. And again, people need to understand that if they can understand and appreciate the process, that's when they value the product. But they first have to understand what's going on. And that's what I try to talk about.
So how did you make the switch then from being in television at a studio to being a travel correspondent?
There's no switch. I'm still doing both. I mean, I'm still producing shows on television. I'm still hosting shows on television. And I have 3 shows on television right now. One is called The Royal Tour, which we've been doing now for 23 years, which is, I like to call it an impossible show, because I go to individual sitting heads of state, kings, presidents, and prime ministers, and I get from them the impossible. They give me 8 days of their schedule, unencumbered, devoted only to me. And then we show up with a crew of 46 specialists, aerial teams, drone teams, underwater teams, mountain climbing teams, motorcycle teams, you name it. And we send all the other gatekeepers home. And then for the next 8 days, that king, president, or prime minister is my personal tour guide to and through their country for a one-hour television special. I should also add, they have no right of editorial control or review. Whatever happens, happens. And we've done that with everybody from the King of Jordan to the President of Mexico, the Prime Minister of New Zealand. We did it with Netanyahu. We've done it with the presidents of Peru and Ecuador, Rwanda, Tanzania, and many others. That's just one of the shows that we do. And now I do another show called Hidden. A concept of that show, which I hope you'll appreciate, is no gift shop, no tour bus, no brochure, no guidebook, no TripAdvisor stickers. But we take you to the most amazing destinations within a country that nobody knows about, but that are totally accessible to you. So we've done Hidden Turkey and Hidden Poland and Hidden Uganda and Hidden Saudi Arabia and Hidden Ireland and Hidden Canary Islands. And we just finished one that's airing now on PBS. So we'd like to say, check your local listings, Hidden Mississippi. And the interesting thing is, it's not just on PBS. You can also access all of these shows on Amazon Prime and Apple TV. So I'm still doing all these shows.
That's amazing.
So there's never been a switch. I'm doing both.
Hidden.
I'm still running around the world, and I'm still doing investigative reporting on air safety.
Hidden Mississippi. How do you choose which destination you're going to focus on when you're doing a show like Hidden?
Well, there are certain destinations that have hidden things in them, and then there are certain destinations that are just plain hidden. Mississippi qualifies as a destination that people just have a stereotypical view. Most people who think about Mississippi go back to a rerun of the Rod Steiger, Sidney Poitier movie In the Heat of the Night, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, I really wanted to get beyond that and explore a place that really didn't get a lot of love. And it's an amazing state. And so we did it differently. This is one, first of all, it's the first one we've done in the U.S. Most of the ones we've done have been overseas. And second of all, we call it America's Hidden Coast, Mississippi, because we just focused on the coastal cities, which has such great history. And it's an amazing story. So that's airing now. But back to your point, I've never given up anything. Some people will say to me, oh, when did you make the switch from journalism to travel? I said, stop right there. Mm-hmm. I've never stopped being a journalist. But I'm not doing soft travel stories. I'm not doing, isn't it wonderful to be in Chicago? That's not what we do.
I particularly loved the Royal Tour. I came to the premiere of the Royal Tour in the Tanzania that you did at Paramount Studios. And that was absolutely fantastic. These must be the most phenomenal trips you take to be escorted around by the head of state in these various countries.
Well, they're the most difficult, I can tell you that. Because you're not just dealing with the head of state, you're dealing with their Secret Service, you're dealing with their army, you're dealing with their internal politics, you're dealing with their internal schedules, weather, and all sorts of other agendas that you have no control over. But the good news is, people always ask me if I like to write. And my answer is, I love having written. On these, I love having done them. Because you saw the premiere. In fact, the head of state always comes to the premiere.
Yeah, so I met her, yeah. Present.
Yeah. And bottom line is, in the end, it humanizes the country and it sort of humanizes the leader, but you're seeing things through their eyes, which nobody ever gets a chance to see. And that's the fun part of it.
Yeah, I really walked out of there with my wife going, you know, we should go to Tanzania. It's just such an incredible place. It's a place that would never be on our list normally, probably, to travel, but incredible. I imagine.
Well, but what you just said is what I rail against, and it's not directed at you. People are always going to say to me when I come back from a trip, where have you just been? And whatever I tell them, you know what the answer that I get from them is? Oh, it's not on my list. And I say, really? Who publishes that list? Where do I find that list? And because I know what's everybody's list. You know what's number one item on everybody's list where they want to go?
Where? Italy.
Paris. Followed by Italy, followed by Spain. You know why? Because you're all failed art history majors. Because
not
you,
me.
You study the painting in school. Well, wait. You study the painting in school. You go, I better go see it at least once. Yeah. You stand in line for 3 hours, come out of the Louvre an hour later going, it's so small.
Yeah. And this is true.
And you probably did that.
Yes.
But the thing is, what we try to do, and this is the most important thing, is to take that list and burn it, right? Mississippi is not on everybody's list, is it? So I sort of have a contrarian view of travel because you can airdrop me into almost anywhere, right? I'm going to find a great time and I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to immerse myself in the culture. And isn't that what travel's supposed to be?
That's what travel's supposed to be. So on that note, what's the most underrated domestic trip people should consider?
Oh, the most underrated domestic trip, that's an easy one for me. It's the Midwest. They don't get a lot of love, right? But you can airdrop me into Iowa, into Indiana, into Wisconsin, into Minneapolis, or Minnesota, I should say, and you can leave me there for a year. I'll be happy because there's so many great stories there. Because it's not just the great stories, it's the great storytellers. And people forgot, until the pandemic, they forgot to rediscover their own country.
Mm-hmm.
And when the pandemic happened, guess what happened? You rediscovered your backyard, your community, your city, because you didn't have a choice. And, you know, I started walking the streets of New York. Usually I take a cab. I started walking. I was discovering things 3 blocks from where I lived, and I've lived in the same building since I'm 6 months old that I had no idea about. And that's exactly, if there was a great byproduct that nobody anticipated from the pandemic, is that Americans got to rediscover their own country. And that's why I gave you that answer about the Midwest, because it's worth rediscovering.
But what's your advice for people who are going to go to maybe a Midwest city and really going to get the most out of it? I mean, do you have to do a tour, like a historical tour or something like that? Or what do you recommend?
Okay, I'm going to tell you something that's going to sound so strange, but it works every time. Where do you think, let's say I've never been to any, forget Midwest, any city in the United States, right? Or any town.
Mm-hmm.
I land there. I've now landed at the airport. Where's the first place I'm going to go to learn about that location? Where would I stop?
Your hotel concierge? I don't know. Is that a terrible answer?
That was a terrible answer.
Okay.
Yeah. No. And the reason is, nothing against concierges, because they can come in handy in so many ways. But I don't want to see a rack of brochures. No. I don't stop at the hotel concierge. I don't stop at the Convention and Visitors Bureau. No, I stop at the firehouse. And you know why? Because firefighters are the best source of information. They've been in everybody's house. They've been in everybody's hotel. They've been in everybody's restaurant. They know where to go. They know where not to go. And they know where to eat. I've never been to a firehouse where I didn't come away from that saying, wow, let's go there. Let's talk to these guys. Let's hang out. And unless there's a 4-alarm fire burning somewhere, they're happy to share their information with you.
So wait, paint this picture for me. You'll land somewhere and then you'll head to the local firehouse and you'll just walk in and say,
absolutely.
Hey,
absolutely.
I'm new in town. Where should I go?
Absolutely. Listen, I'm not kidding.
That's amazing.
And I should also tell you in the interest of full disclosure, I'm also a fireman. I've been a fireman since I was 17. I'm on duty 3 days a week, 7 months a year. I was just on duty 2 days ago. But that doesn't stop it. I tell everybody to do it, whether they're a firefighter or not. And they think I'm crazy until they do it. Then they come back and they go, oh, my God, I found the most amazing location because these guys told me to turn left. And I'm telling you, it's worthwhile doing it.
So you're a volunteer firefighter in New York?
Yep. I'm a volunteer firefighter in New York. Most people don't realize 74% of all firefighters in America are volunteer. It's something that I was asked to do at 17. I was able to join at 18, and I've been a member, an active member ever since.
So you're running into burning buildings with hoses and equipment and all that kind of stuff?
All that kind of stuff. Yep. As volunteers, we have the same training as NYFD. And literally, you know, I'm talking to you today, 2 days ago, I had 5 different alarms. Luckily, 2 were medical and 2 were false. And 1 was an electrical fire we were able to handle right away.
That's incredible. Okay. What about if you're going international? I'm curious to hear the most underrated international trip. And also, what's your process for learning about a new city if you're traveling internationally? Same thing, firehouse?
Well, yes, unless language is a barrier, but it usually isn't. That's a great way to go. But you asked the question about underrated. Remember, there are 196 countries in the world. I've been really lucky. I've been to 152 of them. That means there's another 44 I haven't been to, and I may never get there. But it also means something else. I've been to 151 more countries than most Americans, because most Americans do not own a passport. How ridiculous is that?
That can't be. Most Americans don't have a passport?
That is correct. Only 41% of Americans have a passport. And that 41% is misleading as well, because up until recently, only about 33%. How did the other 8% happen? They changed the rules about going to Mexico or Canada. You have to have a passport. So that bumped it up to 41. But that 8%, those aren't leisure travelers. Those are truckers, guys who have to drive across the border with their goods and stuff. So it's still an embarrassing figure. And what's even more embarrassing about it, I listened to this guy one day. I said, where do you live? I live in Kansas. Oh, great. Now I've been to Kansas, right? We'll talk about it. And he said, well, you travel all over the world. I said, I do. He says, you know what? I said, do you have a passport? No. And he was proud about it. I said, you don't have a passport? What do I need a passport for? I got everything I need in Kansas. Oh, boy. Well, that's a lot of people in America. It's sad. The passport is the best investment you can have to broaden your horizons. And it sounds like a bad second grade textbook, but it's true. It's about $170 a year now, I think. It could be a little bit less than that. It's good for 10 years. Is seeing the world worth $17 a year for you? Oh, my goodness. But it's amazing how many people don't have it. And what's even more amazing is how many of them are happy that they don't have it.
Yeah, that is crazy. Although, you know, I guess if you're in the very middle of the country like that, maybe traveling internationally seems I mean, you know, there's an ocean on either side and you got to travel halfway across the country just to get to the ocean. And then you got to cross the ocean and it can seem maybe daunting to a lot of people.
You know what? It's only daunting until you do it once. Let me tell you something. Right now, we have state-of-the-art aircraft that have unbelievably unlimited range capability. I mean, not really unlimited, but unbelievable range capability, so that you can fly nonstop now from Singapore to New York. That's nonstop, almost 19 hours. So you can go from Chicago to Dubai, not a problem. You can go from Doha to Auckland, not a problem.
Right.
So we have the airplanes now that can do extreme long haul in relative comfort. And next thing you know, you just get that out of the way. And the next morning you're waking up in a brave new world. And how cool is that?
Well, I agree with you on this. You heard the saying, travel is the only thing you can buy that makes you richer.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's so true. We've got one of those long trips planned later this year. We're going to the Philippines and that's a 16-hour flight.
Listen, you're going to love it. The Philippines is more than 8,000 islands. Do you know where you're going in the Philippines?
Oh yeah, my wife is from the Philippines, and so we're returning to where she came from. She was born in Manila, and so we're flying into Manila. We're seeing a lot of family. We're going to go to Boracay. We're going to go to Bohol. We're going to go to Tagaytay, a bunch of different places, as many places that we can fit in, you know, in 2 weeks.
Well, then, if you get a chance, go down to Palawan and go to Legazpi. Go down to Zamboanga in Mindanao.
Yeah.
You'll never have better seafood. Puerto Princesa in Palawan, some of the most beautiful water you will ever, ever see. And the volcano is still active in Legazpi. It's amazing to watch. But once again, you're going to take that 16-hour flight and boom, once you're there, you're there. And you're going to love it.
Have you ever been somewhere where you felt like you were in danger?
Oh, yeah. LaGuardia. No, I'm kidding. But not much. We have to get down to a definition of danger, right? I mean, look, I've been deported from a country once. I've been in the middle of like 3 or 4 different civil wars, ranging from, believe it or not, the Philippines to the Sudan and many other places. But, you know, the key of successful travel is being streetwise and not necessarily knowing where to go, but knowing where not to go. So, you know, I was over in Saudi during Gulf War I. I was in the first flight into Kuwait after Gulf War I ended, when the oil fields were still on fire. Now you'd say, what does that got to do with travel? There's a lot to do with travel. And, you know, we could spend another 2 hours explaining that, but it does. And I was in Guatemala. It was very tough. 9 out of the 11 people I interviewed on the story were dead the next day because they talked to me. That was when it was run by a military dictatorship that had no sense of humor, if you can get my drift. Now, I'm not standing here telling you, oh, wow, look at me, Mr. You know, adventure traveler. But I'm saying, with 196 countries in the world, right now, as I'm talking on the phone, there are probably 26 different wars being fought. Now, you may be aware of Ukraine, of course, but then there are the Houthis in Yemen. There's also stuff going on in Chechnya. We go through the whole list of what's going on in Africa. Remember, there are 54 countries in Africa, and not all of those countries are having a stable moment at this moment. So, but that doesn't stop me from traveling. You know, of the 196 countries in the world,
not to those countries.
I'm sorry, oh, yeah, I've been to all of them, right? Now, are there countries I wouldn't go to? You bet. And I'll tell you by metric for that. I will not go to any country where I don't know who's in control, right? So would I go to North Korea tomorrow? Yes, I've been there twice because I know who's in control. Would I go to Iran tomorrow? Yeah, I know who's in control. You play by the rules. Would I go to parts of Chechnya tomorrow? No, I don't know who's in control. Syria, no. Would I go to parts of Iraq tomorrow? Absolutely, because I know it's in control, right? Especially in the Kurdish areas. So if you do your homework, there are only about 4 or 5 places in the world I wouldn't go.
And where's that?
And, well, I named a couple of them. There's parts of Chechnya. There's parts of the Congo right now. Yemen is not a good idea because kidnapping has become a national pastime. Russia right now for all the obvious reasons. But I'm running out of places,
yeah.
Right? Maybe Camden, New Jersey, I wouldn't go, you know? But I mean...
Why you got to pick on Camden, New Jersey?
Well, hey, they pick on themselves. What are you talking about? But Camden, New Jersey, I would go to. How about that? I would even go to Camden.
Even Camden. But let's face it, you probably wouldn't recommend, like us, my family of four, two young kids, travel to North Korea, right?
Absolutely. To tell you the truth, I wouldn't have a problem with that. There is organized tourism in North Korea if you play by the rules. Now, it's not the tourism that you're coming to expect. It's probably not going to be one that your kids would enjoy. But if you're talking about just issues of safety and personal security, if you play by the rules, you're not going to get in trouble. Now, would that be my first recommendation for family travel right now? Of course not. But I'm saying Americans don't do a good job of their homework before they go somewhere. I think State Department advisories are misleading at best and inaccurate at best, even if they're well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always railed against them. I much rather read the advisories given by the British Foreign Office to their citizens. They do a better job, and you can easily access those online. The other thing I do, with very few exceptions, there's almost always an English language newspaper printed in the destination where you want to go. It's accessible online. Go online and read the last 3 weeks of issues. You'll determine right away whether you want to go. Just read the newspaper.
So you're saying, okay, so ignore these warnings. Like, you know, they issue warnings. Like,
No. You don't ignore them. You have to read them with the proper context, right? Do you know what the State Department advisory is for Turkey? I can read it to you.
No.
Most people don't read them. Be advised that Turkish drivers pass on the left and the right. Have they been on the 405? I mean, is that going to stop me from going to Turkey? Of course not. You know the one is for Indonesia? Americans are warned to stay away from large crowds and avoid buses. I live in L.A. and I avoid large crowds and avoid buses. You know why? Because in L.A., I've never taken the bus. You know why? I have absolutely no idea where they go. And that's the real terrorism. I want to get on a bus. I'm never coming back.
Right.
So all kidding aside, read the State Department advisories. They're advisories, number one. Put them in perspective. If there's a riot in Cincinnati, does that mean you can't go to Cleveland? Of course not. But these are painted with such a broad brush that it's a disservice to us. It really is.
I thought you lived in New York. You said you spent some time in L.A.?
I live both in New York and Los Angeles. Yes, I've been doing bi-coastal since I'm 21 years age. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Well, we're here. We're based here in Century City. Where are you?
I'm in Marina Del Rey.
Well, are you there now?
No, I'm actually in Gulfport, Mississippi right now.
Oh, nice. Is that from finishing up Hidden? Or?
Yep. That we're finishing up Hidden, Mississippi. That's right. And nice. So but from here, a day after tomorrow, I take that back. Tomorrow night, I fly to Shanghai and Hong Kong to do another show. And then from there, we go to Alabama. And then from there, I'm going to Europe. So, I mean, it never ends.
After you return from traveling from abroad, what's the first thing you do when you get back home?
Make sure I have enough underwear.
Living in L.A., I don't know if this is like an American thing or just an Angelino thing. First thing I do is go to In-N-Out. You ever hear that?
I'm a pescatarian, but my wife is from Turkey. I haven't lived my entire life as a pescatarian. So the very first thing I did when she came out to visit me the first time in L.A., I said, I went out to LAX. You know the In-N-Out burger at LAX, and you can't miss it, right?
Yeah.
And I took her there, and she's become an addict. She cannot get enough.
Oh, it's the best. And when you're coming back into LA, you know, you see it. Just like something in your brain, you're like, I have to have it. That's the first thing I have to have when I come back is
all the plane spotters hang out in their parking lot because their parking lot looks right out on runway 24 right. So all the great pictures that are posted online of planes landing at LAX are taken from the parking lot at In-N-Out Burger.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Inflation has surged over the past few years, and travel is no exception to that. I'm sure you've felt it, experienced it. Give us some tips for traveling on a budget.
Well, I'm going to tell you something that's pretty disturbing, and that is this, and many of the people listening to this program right now may be victims of this already, and that is when we came out of the pandemic, everybody wanted to travel. And everybody called it revenge travel. No, it wasn't revenge travel. It was refocused travel. People took money they were otherwise going to spend on clothing or a new car or new jewelry, and they said, I'm going to go travel. And they did. But they did it without respect for price. And a lot of them put it on their credit cards. And they got more and more credit cards because they kept on getting more and more offers from these banks to get credit cards with bonus miles and all sorts of extra points at 25% interest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unsecured consumer credit card debt right now is over $1.3 trillion at 25% interest, which is being compounded. It's scary.
Yeah.
So here's my tip. Don't buy something if you can't afford it, number one. Number two, always understand the cyclical nature of travel and pricing. So we're in a situation right now, as we're now in the middle of October and in the middle of the fourth quarter, which is becoming an amazing buyer's market for travel. Why? Three things. One, what I already mentioned, people maxed out their credit cards. And since only 49% of Americans pay their credit card bills in full every month, right? That means there are a lot of people there at 25% interest who can never get ahead of their balance.
Mm-hmm.
They can't win the catch-up game. And all of a sudden, these bills have come in from the first 8 months of travel for 2024. And they went, whoops, I'm not going to travel for the rest of the year. I got to get ahead of it. Then it's an election year. What's happening in 2.5 weeks? A presidential election. And every 4 years, Americans tend to travel a whole lot less in the last 3 months of the year, not because it's a red issue or a blue issue, but because it's the uncertainty of a national election. They just pull back. And so you have these, all of these things operating at the same time to create an amazing buyer's market if you have any money left. And I'll give you an example. This past summer, what was the round-trip airfare between JFK and LAX, a route I know very well? What do you think it was?
Round trip, JFK, LAX. Jeez, I'd be taking a stab in the dark here. $400?
No, it's about $800.
Okay.
It was very high. You know what it is right now?
No.
$220. In New York City, the cab ride to the airport is almost that. So it's a buyer's market.
Wow.
Right? How about this? JFK to London this past summer, $2,200 in coach. Outrageous. In coach.
Wow.
In business class, they were getting $12,000 and they were filling the planes. You know what it is right now in coach?
No.
$630. So it is a great time to travel as long as you understand a contrarian view of travel. And that is seasonality is no longer on the table. You're not going to fly to London to get a suntan. You're not going to go lie off the beach in November in Venice, but you're going to see an immersion possibility for you where there are going to be no crowds, no lines, better service, and better deals all around. Because if the airfares have dropped, I guarantee you the hotel rates have dropped. And you add all that up, it becomes a great time to travel.
Well, you know, you're speaking my language when you mentioned the credit card debt, because we work in the financial planning world. Of course, we would never let our clients accumulate credit card debt. But, you know, I always found that travel is much, much more enjoyable when it's already been paid for. And so we budget those things into our clients' plans. But I can't help but ask you, do you use a specific kind of card for travel?
Well, now you've opened the door to a conversation that I could go for 3 hours.
Uh-oh.
Because one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on America right now are airline frequent flyer programs. It didn't start out that way. It started out as a bona fide loyalty program, right? Mm-hmm. You flew an airline, you flew a certain number of miles, certain number of flights, and you were rewarded for your loyalty. That's why they were called loyalty programs. Well, they may still call them that, but they're not based on how many flights you take or how many miles you earn. It's based on how much money you spend. And so the airlines under deregulation are not regulated in terms of what they're required to do when you get to a certain mileage level. They can change the rules at any time. By the way, they do. They can change the redemption levels at any time. By the way, they do. And they can basically restrict flights in which there are no award seats available, even if the flight is going empty. Because they make so much money, this is something that most Americans do not know, they make more money from their frequent flyer programs than they make operating as airlines. So for those people, to answer your question, who have a credit card that's linked to a mileage program of a particular airline, you're getting ripped off double. Because, first of all, it's a high interest rate card. And second of all, you're paying a high membership fee. Oh, yeah, and there's number three, you're earning miles you can't redeem. The average redemption levels per year on an airline in their frequent flyer program, 8%. Whoa.
Whoa. Right? 8%.
Yeah,
whoa. That's wild.
8%. Wait, it gets worse. how many unredeemed frequent flyer miles are there out there right now? I'm talking about miles that you've earned, that I've earned, that everybody listening to us has earned, right? And that they can't redeem. Take a guess.
It's got to be in the hundreds of millions.
Well, you're not going to the showcase showdown. It's 34 trillion. Yeah.
That's an unfathomable number. Our debt will and get there soon. No, I'm kidding.
And so the frequent flyer programs have become the wild, wild west, and there's no sheriff. And everybody's getting angry now because, you know, they can't redeem the miles. So look how much money they spend in interest to buy products that they're getting 1 mile per dollar. Right? That's just the money they're spending on interest to earn miles that they can't redeem. It's the best system ever developed that basically meets the level of the definition of a criminal fraud.
That's wild. That's so wild. Okay, I asked you about credit cards. Let me ask you about this. Do you use an online one of those online travel booking sites when you're booking your travel?
I look at it for research only, and I'll tell you why. Everybody does it because it's convenient. They don't have to talk to a human being. They could do it at 3 o'clock in the morning in their bathrobe, and they hit all those keystrokes and think they're smart. They're idiots. And they're well-intentioned idiots, but they're idiots. How many times have you gone online, admit it now, and you've seen only 2 seats left? Only 3 rooms left. And you, I got to hit the keystroke and get it.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
The inventory, right. You know it. The inventory that you're seeing on your screen is not it's not the entire inventory. It's only the inventory they want to show you. It's only based on the allocation of those tickets or seats that were given to an online travel agency by the travel provider. Did you ever think of going on their website? Did you ever think of calling a travel agent or a travel advisor? Because what they're seeing on their screen is absolutely not what you're seeing on your screen. And you're misled. Whether it's a hotel, an airline, a rental car, it's garbage. So go ahead and use the internet to research. But before you buy, have a conversation. I know people are not inclined to talk to human beings these days. But you know what? There's a reason why they made a cell phone initially. It was to have a conversation, not to do TikTok. Get on the phone and get somebody on the phone who can give you that inventory. And now you can be a good comparison shopper.
Yeah, I've heard that they'll track your internet traffic too. And so, you know, you go and you check it out and then you'll go back again. Suddenly it's gone up in price.
Well, it's worse than that. It's called big data, right? A lot of it's AI. So for example, I needed to go from Los Angeles to New York for one of the shows that I do, but I didn't know if I had to leave on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So I went online just to see what the fare was. And in those days, I think it was like, you know, $428. I said, well, that's okay. I can live with that. But I wouldn't know for the next 6 hours whether I had to go on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So 6 hours later, when I found out it had to be a Tuesday, I went back online and that same fare on that same flight had gone up $70. And so I called the airlines and I said, can you please explain this? And they had what seemed to be a legitimate answer. They said, well, you know, LA New York is a very popular transcon route. A lot of people fly it. So it's the law of supply and demand. So more people want it, the fare goes up as the number of seats decreases. I said, okay, I'll take you at your word for that. But then I went back online the next night and did a test. This is back in November. So I looked up a flight in March from LaGuardia to Des Moines, Iowa on a Wednesday at 11 a.m. and found a flight round trip for $228. I went back online 5 hours later, right? At 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
That same flight had gone up to $288. Nobody can make the argument to me that at that hour of the morning, there were 50,000 deranged passengers who were determined to fly to Des Moines, Iowa, 5 months later at 11 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday. So the lesson that I learned and that I now share with everybody else is if you want to go online to research, before you go back online to buy, either clean out your cookies or use somebody else's computer.
Yeah, that's good advice. Talk to me about seatbelts and airplanes. I know you have some beliefs about that.
Well, Well, people get mad at me about this. But you know what? I have some statistics to prove it. When seatbelts were first designed for airplanes, planes took off at about 80 miles an hour. That's when they became airborne. Well, that's no longer the case. Planes take off at about 160 miles an hour, and they land at about 140 to 160 miles an hour. So they always want you to put your seatbelt on before takeoff or landing.
Right.
That's when I don't wear my seatbelt, because in the event of an aborted landing at that speed, or a hard landing, or an aborted takeoff, the pressure around my pelvis from that seatbelt will break my pelvis. And while I may survive the actual incident, guess what? I die from the toxic smoke because I can't get off the plane. So the only time I suggest people absolutely wear their seatbelt at all times is once you're in the air, because clear air turbulence is really hurting a lot of people these days. Helped by global warming and different climate conditions, you're seeing more and more incidents of turbulence that cannot be anticipated, and people getting severely injured. We even had a case over the summer where somebody was killed.
Yeah.
So it's wear your seatbelt at all times in the air.
This is the opposite of what they tell you on the plane, is buckle up for land, and then they'll let you take your seatbelt off during mid-flight. But yeah, you're right. You can't really see clear air turbulence. It just hits you.
Yeah.
I know we're wealth managers here by trade. So what's the best, I know, beside traveling the world, which is of course definitely a huge benefit to you, but what's the best financial decision you've ever made?
You're going to laugh. I mean, you're really going to laugh, because it goes against everything you've ever talked about, I'm sure. But when the earthquake happened in 1994 in Los Angeles, I lost my house. In fact, it had to be bulldozed.
Oh, wow. I remember. Yeah, I remember the 94 quake.
Now, that was not the best financial decision I ever made. Now, the best financial decision I ever made was, where was I going to live? And I realized that whatever survived the earthquake in terms of material items had to go into storage. My house became a vacant lot. It was going to be years before I could rebuild it. And so what did I do? I went out and I bought a boat. And I bought a boat in the marina. So I've had that boat now for 30 years. It's the best financial decision I ever made.
This is the first time I have ever heard that answer to that question.
I know. I knew you would.
Because you know what they say, the best 2 days of owning a boat are when you buy it and when you sell it.
Well, I beg to differ. I mean,
that's amazing.
That boat to me,
So you live on the boat.
Marina Del Rey. Yeah. That's my house.
That's your house.
Marina Del Rey is the largest small craft man-made marina in the world. Over 8,000 boats, of which at any given time, I think three ever leave the dock. My boat is the exception. I take it out all the time and I use it.
Yeah.
So it's not just recreation. It's where I live. And you never sleep better than you sleep on a boat. I'm very close to the airport. Whoever wants to get stuck on a freeway, not me. Mm-hmm. And you know what? From a cost perspective, I pay less in property taxes. I pay less in maintenance because the boat is used. If you don't use the boat, you're going to be paying a lot in maintenance.
Yeah, that's right.
So to me, that's the best decision I ever made. However, my business manager is always on my case. What are you doing with the boat? Sell the boat. Right? Because they're looking at a P&R, you know?
Right.
And I'm saying, guys, or P&L, excuse me.
P&L.
And I'm saying, I said P&R, because that's the code. That's your six-digit code when you make a reservation on an airline. That stands for passenger name record. I'm sorry about that. But P&L, you know exactly what that means.
Yes.
And it's not a return on investment.
Yeah.
It's a return on experience. It's a return on life. And for that, let's go to the MasterCard commercial. For me, that's priceless.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on about 4 different television shows, ranging from Namibia to Alabama to Hong Kong to another one I can't even mention yet. Then, of course, I'm working on, I've done a number of books. I've done about 14 books. I'm working on my autobiography. I figure my might as well write one. And so that'll be out by the end of next year in 2025. And then, of course, in any given week, I'm working on travel as front page news. So within 5 minutes of me talking to you, the dynamics may change, and I may be on a plane going somewhere I had no intention of going to.
Where can people find you?
Well, we've got a website, which we had a committee spending hours to come up with a name. It's petergreenberg.com.
Love it.
And it's a newsletter. We are not transactional in any way. We sell nothing on it. It's informational only. It's free. Sign up for it. You'll get it every week. And that'll give you a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today, but updated form all the time. You can also find me on Amazon and Apple TV Plus. If you go to those sites, just punch up my name. You'll see all the shows we do and all the shows we've done. And of course, on the radio, my radio show we've been doing for 28 years for CBS. It's 3 hours a week from a different location in the world every single week. And you can always access it through your local radio station. Or if you can't find one in your market, it's easy. You just go to petergreenberg.com every Saturday. At about 5 minutes after 7 on the Pacific side, 5 minutes after 10 a.m. on New York time, and it's streamed live for 3 hours.
Amazing. Yeah, I get your newsletter. I enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on. You're a wealth of knowledge, and really appreciate you taking the time today.
And if you have any frequent flyer miles, don't bank them. You get no interest on them. Redeem them as fast as you can.
That's good advice. All right. Peter, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Happy to do it, man. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Peter Greenberg. Peter helps us realize that travel doesn't have to be intimidating. Neither do your finances. Sometimes you just need a guide to help point you in the right direction. If I can help you, please reach out to me at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Now, here's a short success story about someone you might know. Some jokes are funny, some jokes are lame, and some jokes turn into billion-dollar empires. Born into a wealthy family on July 2, 1904, in Paris, France, René had the luxury of pursuing many interests. While accompanying his father on a trip to England, he fell in love with the game of tennis. Despite the objections of his father, who had plans for him to enroll in a prestigious French engineering school, at age 15, he expressed his ambitions to go pro. His father conceded with one stipulation. He had 5 years to become a world champion. Determined to meet the challenge, René began intensely training. The French Open, initially exclusive to French club members, opened to global amateurs in 1925, becoming an International Tennis Federation major. René won the inaugural Open and also triumphed at Wimbledon that year. He secured 11 major titles and helped France win the 1927 Davis Cup, earning him induction into the Tennis Hall of Fame in 1976. René's most enduring legacy, however, would not come from tennis. It came from a bet he made with his French Davis Cup team captain. If René won a crucial match, he would give him a reptile skin suitcase, which he had been eyeing. After losing the bet, his friend designed an image of that particular reptile, a crocodile, and embroidered it on his blazer as a joke, which René, in good humor, wore on the courts. And that's the story of how René Lacoste created the iconic crocodile polo. And that's the way he did it. Thank you again for listening. And a special thank you to producer Jake, content manager Angeline, and everyone else who made this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode of Success Unscripted, please like and share. If you have feedback, or if you or someone you know would be a good guest for our show, please reach out to us at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.